Hello, good afternoon. Today I have Imam Khalid Latif with me on this podcast, and it's going to be a slight interview, which we're going to be talking about religious interfaith and experience and significance. Thank you so much for having me over here.
Thanks for letting me be a part of it.
Yeah. So I know you studied at Princeton undergrad. How was that like?
I didn't. I worked at Princeton.
Oh, you worked at Princeton. Yeah. All right, okay.
But I did my undergrad at New York University.
So you've been here, and then you graduated at Princeton, or?
I did my undergrad at NYU.
Undergrad at NYU.
And you worked at Princeton. I started to work at NYU in 2005.
Right.
And in 2006, Princeton had a position open, like as a pilot for a chaplaincy.
Yeah.
So they were starting out as a part-time Muslim chaplain, and I got the position there. Very and then reason. In 2007, my position at NYU became full-time, and I also was asked by the mayor of New York to take on a position as a chaplain for the NYPD.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
I did that for 11 years while I worked at NYU full-time.
How was that
full-time.
Like? That was good. It was good.
But I left it in 2018.
To come here.
I've been here full-time.
Been here full-time. Okay, so that was like a side hustle. Yeah, that's good. So I'm just going to be asking you a couple questions.
Sure.
What do you think the purpose of interfaith dialogue is, in your opinion? What does it achieve? What are the outcomes?
I think the purpose of interfaith dialogue really depends on the individuals that are involved. Mm. If you were to ask me what it should be, I would say the purpose of good religion, regardless of the faith tradition, is that it should bring its practitioner to take on societal ailments. And if one's practice of religion doesn't do that, then one would need to figure out, well, what's the point of my practice of religion? You definitely don't want to be on the other end of the spectrum where you're contributing to social unrest and inequity, oppression, etc. And so the objective, I would say, of interfaith dialogue is to bring people together in their own sense of identity and work towards the achieving of a common good in a tangible way. One of the challenges that can come up in dialogue, regardless of who the participants are or what's the nature of it, cross-cultural, interreligious, etc., is that it has the challenge of becoming very ceremonial or superficial. It can be very tokenizing. But where there's substantive change and impact and an opportunity for there to be a recognition of the diversity of individuals involved and where there might be discrepancy in terms of privilege, power, dynamics as such, it can lead towards a lot of important outcomes, right? Because people don't get along so well together, and people are very separate and segmented from one another, you know?
You mentioned the idea of tokenizing. Can you just elaborate on that?
It's really easy. I mean, if you were in a place where you wanted to demonstrate to a mass population that you appreciate diversity, so that it's not just a checkbox but there's pluralism, then you would get to a place where you could say, look, I did hire somebody from a different race. Look, we do have this conversation with so-and-so and such who's a representative of a underrepresented community.
Trying to gain publicity and diversity, equity, inclusion. And so that other people can recognize that.
Well, you can get to a place where you're kind of appeasing or overlooking what is an actual challenge by being able to demonstrate that I have engaged in a way. And there's no shortage of individuals that are fully willing to take on positions or roles or fulfill certain kind of niches for self-gain rather than communal kind of gain, do you know?
Yeah.
And it can be challenging. A lot of institutions that exist, systems and structures, especially in the United States, are rooted in a very deeply entrenched anti-blackness. Supremacy is kind of the base of all of these things, and whiteness in and of itself is considered to be a primordial state. And when you look at how race and class are things that have plagued the United States as challenging obstacles for real harmonious existence since the country's inception. Those two things also impact individuals who are coming from religious minority experiences.
Okay. That makes sense. It's perfect. Do you think that there are any dilemmas that could arise from good faith efforts in terms of interfaith, like events and discussions? Or do you have any thoughts on how we might better manage concerns in such a multi-faith society, primarily in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think even where people are well-intentioned, there's always a danger of very performative solidarity. You know, you pick and choose when you stand with the minority community as opposed to just wholeheartedly. I think individuals can adopt a savior complex that they go in and feel as if they know what someone needs rather than following the lead of the demographic. And not always essentially recognizing their own internal biases that might exist or creating frameworks that are problematic, like a good Muslim or bad Muslim.
Yeah.
Who gets to make those determinations? And where and how is somebody going to be just enough of what is acceptable, as opposed to on their own able to determine their level of practice and commitment to faith? And so efforts might also, if someone is not fully acquainted with what an actual like narrative is,
yes,
you know, what an experience is, they might be contributing more to the longevity of a challenge than actually helping to remedy something in some capacity. And it's really hard because you look at Muslims, for example, there's no homogeneity in the Muslim community.
No.
And if someone was to work with Muslims, you could pretty much work with people from any racial, cultural, ethnic background, you know, and that includes Black people, white people, Latinos, South Asians, Arabs, Indonesian. I mean, across the board, it could be anybody. So to get somebody that's representative of that diverse demographic is pretty tough.
Yeah.
As well as then thinking about the multiple facets that people represent, needs are going to vary from people to people and community to community. You don't come with just a single variable of your identity. And it could create
challenge. There's many that could define a human being. But I like how you mentioned that we all have our, like, biases towards our own religions. And this could take place in, like, many places. Like,
well, I don't even think it's a bias towards religion. Like, if you are a religious person,
yeah,
your religion is just one part of who you are.
That's true.
Right? And if I'm a religious person, my religion is just part of me in one way. But when you go down the street, somebody is going to see you also through the brownness of your skin, and they will have an internal bias against you, implicit, right? Cognitively,
that's a big issue.
We all have this function of stereotyping.
That's true.
It just helps us to process more, but it can also render intellectual laziness. And so people come in and they have kind of preconceived ideas and notions and perceptions. So it's not always just biased towards religion, or even what they might assume is biased towards religion is actually biased towards something else, right? Like, I do a lot of interfaith work, churches, synagogues, temples, you know, everyday local communities, as well as like sitting with people who are the heads of various Protestant denominations. I've shared the stage with the Dalai Lama and the Pope.
Oh,
and,
really?
You know, done programs like that. And quite often when I go into certain spaces, I'm the first Muslim many people have met. And a common question that I'll get is, you know, we didn't know you believe what you believe. And I'll say to them, what you're really asking me is, why don't we like you so much? And I'll say, your challenges with me are not in anything theological, because I have a God the way you have a God, right? Conceptually, we can understand the concept of God.
Yes.
You have holidays, and I have holidays, and we have prayer, and you have prayer, and all these kinds of things. The reason you don't like me so much has nothing to do with my theology, but it has everything to do with these things that really permeate American society, which are challenges around race and ethnicity. And it creates now very easily accepted narratives of the other that you've never spent time with. By embracing what is purposeful, rooted in fear, to get you to think the worst of a demographic, in a way that is quite often not anything of who they are.
Okay. So who do you think, actually, can you elaborate on how were the discussions? I know you mentioned how the discussions, you shared the stage with the Pope, right? The Dalai Lama. What were some of the, if you don't mind, what were some of the topics like about, other than the time you explained to the participant what Islam actually was? And
I mean, it varies. You know, we did something in Alabama around Martin Luther King Jr.
Okay.
with the Dalai Lama. There was like news articles and media interviews that I've done with other religious like figures. With the Pope, we were speaking at the Ground Zero site on the anniversary of September 11th.
Okay.
And it was about bringing together individuals of diverse backgrounds in a moment of solidarity and hope.
Yeah.
They're all very meaningful kind of gatherings.
Very different experiences.
Yeah. Different experiences.
But they meant, they were very meaningful to you.
Yeah.
And who do you think should be involved in interfaith dialogue and discussion? And in your experience, who tends to be missing from such discussions?
Religion on a whole tends to be very much focused on men.
Yeah.
And that's one challenge. And then interfaith dialogue tends to focus much on Abrahamic traditions and not really engage non-Abrahamic traditions. And you have a lot more religious representation than just Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, and where and how, if you're looking at multi-faith more broadly, recognizing the need of diversity in that regard. I think also the nature of conversations and who's present and who's absent can at times be very much so purposeful. I was in Sri Lanka doing work with...
Can it have a big impact?
Yeah, it can have a huge impact, you know. When I was in Sri Lanka, I was doing work with internally displaced populations. So twice over, when the governmental regime was the Tamil Tigers, they had expelled large groups of Muslims from their hometowns. And they were just living in the wilderness, no infrastructure, outside of cities. And I met with various groups and people, you know, in this government, people who worked in nonprofit sectors, etc., some of the actual internal refugees. And one of the groups I met with was an interfaith council.
Okay.
And there were people sitting around a circular table. It's probably like 30 people representing various groups. And there was one empty seat. And I said, who sits there? And they said, that is the person who represents the Buddhist community. And in Sri Lanka, the majority was the Buddhist community. And they said, they don't really ever come. So you had all of these people who were from like underrepresented minority yep. demographics. And the demographic that was in the majority, they were just not playing yeah. a role. And that's going to impact kind of what you fundamentally are able to do and not able to do. Where you can also, though, see a benefit in minority populations coming together, building power through coalition building, increasing numbers on, like, you know, similar viewpoints and policy points. But somebody could put together anything strategically, and it's not necessarily representative of multiple voices. It's just reinforcing a pre-planned kind of set of objectives that orchestrates what an outcome would be. Do you know?
Yes.
And you don't want to have a photo opportunity, right? You want to have something substantive that allows for people to come together, recognize like our humanity, and sanctify that as a mechanism for then kind of going out and doing really good work.
So why do you think that the Buddhist community might not have showed up?
Because they didn't need to. There's no accountability, right? It's the same reason as to why, you know, we have a prison industrial complex, a military industrial complex.
Yeah.
Why do we have children in cages at our borders? Why is there poor health care for those in need? Why are school systems built in the ways that they are? Why is there no consequence when, you know, black people are shot in the streets and by law enforcement nonetheless? Right? These are questions that have an opportunity to look at these acts as like an ends or even a beginning, but really they're just symptomatic of something that's more deeply entrenched. And where and how you have these dynamics of privilege and power, they intersect with a lot of what this industry can be. And faith in and of itself also plays a really important role in so many different arenas. So you see how it's an effective way to mobilize people during election times, whether those are local, state, or federal, and how politics becomes deeply intertwined with how many faith communities function. Yep. As a mechanism, as a tool to be able to get people behind you, so to speak. Do you know? And so if I am in a powerful position, I'm of the majority or I'm of a privileged background, why would I need to help someone, right? Other than it's the right thing to do. And most people don't fundamentally do that, unfortunately.
Because they don't see that side, that it's, you know, the right thing to do.
Or they're comfortable with doing wrong things to minorities, right? Yeah. Like, if you've ever
watched...
There's
all these issues, but around those issues, there's one central reason or one central motive, or... that one central motive or supremacy, right, creates all these different problems, as you said. Like, why isn't it no consequences for hate crimes, right? Why is there, why back then were whites superior?
It's not even back then. I mean, you live in a society that's very deeply impacted. When I worked at Princeton, like you asked me,
because that legacy from back then is carried on to today.
Well, it's what the basis of all these institutions are. Yeah. I was 24 when I worked at Princeton.
Okay.
And when I got there, Princeton's Princeton. So I was meeting people like Cornel West, who used to be at Princeton, and Toni Morrison, who has since passed. And, you know, this is in 2006. So I've met some of the people who were part of the founding of Amazon.com, you know, way back when. And they introduced me to somebody and said, you know, her husband is responsible for the resurgence of China's economy, right? It was a lot of just really amazing, talented people. In my head, I was, what am I doing here? And then my second week at Princeton, I started to get letters from people saying, from alumni.
Okay.
And they were saying, we don't want Muslims at Princeton. We don't want your Sharia law at Princeton. Somebody like you should never be at a place like this. When I went to ask my supervisors, the head of religious life, they said that these people are upset because simultaneous to my hiring, the dean of the chapel, a really nice person named Tom Breitenthal, who went on to become the Archbishop of Southern Ohio, they were searching for someone to take his role. And they said, they think we hired you for that position. And I said, well, that's not any better. Like, it's much worse. Why couldn't I be the head? Because I'm Muslim. One of the things that happens at Princeton every year is, you know, they have a lot of Princeton pride, and they do this parade that they call the P-Rade at graduation time. And the oldest alums to the most recent alums all come and march in this parade, and they're wearing like white suits with orange pinstripes. And the way the parade is structured is you have the eldest alums at the beginning, and at the end are the most recent alums. And you have literally decades of classes that pass, and it's all white men.
Oh, okay.
At some point, you might get a little bit of diversity
that's really
of color, of some women. But by the end of it, even the most recent class years are still like white men. One of the things that happens at a lot of college campuses around the country is an unofficial baccalaureate ceremony called the Pan-African Baccalaureate, where black and brown students, and of them mostly black, and of them mostly African-American, have their own unofficial graduation. And I was asked to speak at Princeton's that year. And the valedictorian of that ceremony was a young black woman who, when she was delivering her remarks, she said to, you know, her graduating peers and friends in attendance and family members that just because we are at Princeton doesn't mean we're of Princeton. And we should always remember the struggles and sacrifices that people have made in order for us to be here. So our degrees, our credentials, our training should never be for self-gain, but should always be for the advancement of our community and for what is mutually beneficial, the common good. And those words really stuck with me. But you have to understand, like, every institution that exists in the United States is rooted in this. And people like you and I, right? My family is also from Pakistan, we're Kashmiri. There's a large influx of immigrants that comes here in the 70s when the United States is trying to increase its rankings in fields like medicine, science, engineering.
That's why they have immigrants all over the world coming.
Yeah, well, they have people from everywhere come, including a large number of Muslims.
Yes.
And that's one demographic of large Muslims in the United States. The second, you know, 30% of slaves that were brought here, at a minimum 30%, were also Muslim.
Yes.
There's been a deep legacy of Islam and black experience. A lot of immigrant Muslims, when they came, they chose to work with white institutions rather than established Muslim communities that came from self-identifying black backgrounds. And you see a lot of challenges that have come up where government, you know, others have scrutinized, detained, deported, domestic and foreign policy. These are things that black people have gone through since the very beginning. And that choice to work with white apparatus instead of black community has had a lot of consequences, and where it becomes also potentially tokenizing. And a point of reflection that's important is it just also contributes and adds to a lot of the inequitous structures and policies that impact minorities across the board, but in particular black people as well. So who's at the table and who's not at the table quite often is determined by the people who are running the table in the first place.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know,
because they're more and more likely to go with their race, their own races, or their own
or
their
people own who are going to say what they want them to say, and not like say things that are challenging or kind of, you know,
controversial,
to do other things.
And I find it really, really fascinating, the period. That it's just, I find it cool that, like, you have majority people are white, and that's because it's such a long time back that in their culture that only white men or young white teens would attend Princeton. And then just going down the generations, you just kind of see the same races.
But it's not even in the, it's in the systems,
it's in the
right?
system, yeah.
Like the European framework through which people left to come to the States years ago as colonists and whatever else, pilgrims, right? That space wasn't one that was seeking to embrace diversity. And where in Europe you had crusades and transatlantic slave trades launched in the name of religion, in the United States, there wasn't battles fought in the name of faith, but the worst battle that takes place in the United States, it's civil war, is fought over principles of race and ethnicity. The founding documents of this country afford full privilege to white men. Women are given nothing, and black people aren't even considered a whole person in comparison to their white counterparts. And all of those things lay the basis of all of these structures and systems that were built purposely in that way. And we see these things still existing. It's not that long ago that a civil rights movement takes place. It's really just like decades ago, right?
Yeah.
And there's still so much that kind of is there that is deeply problematic, and every day it's just more undeniable. Yeah.
And it's kind of hard to get ourselves out of the knot that America has put ourselves in. You know, we as people, we've put ourselves into this knot.
I didn't put myself
No, I know.
You didn't put yourself into anything either, but language is really important.
Language is important,
right?
Yeah.
But that's where also a system seeks to get you in your head that says that you are somehow deserving of the place that you put yourself in. And
solely
that's not
just
the case.
Solely just because of your race, just culture, ethnicity.
Yeah, right. And it creates tropes like if you just work harder, then you'll get something or the other. Right?
But because it's been reminded and it's been in your head so much, you don't believe that you could achieve great things, but you believe that, you know, I'm in my position, right? I can't do anything about it. But I think it's really important that we try to, you know, work past those means and we try to do better for ourselves. Because, I mean, you can accomplish anything as long as you are willing to put in the hard work.
I don't think so. I think there's many people who they have ceilings put in front of them because of these systems that are in place. And that's an important thing to understand. Most colleges that you go to, most corporate like settings, even if you look at like major sports, the majority of people who run these things, they're head coaches, they are presidents of companies, CEOs.
So they would
tend
have their
to be
own
white
internal,
men, right?
internal biases.
Well, they have white men. It's not that they have just themselves their biases, but the practices, the structures,
it's
the systems,
white men.
Right? But you also have this kind of notion that pushes this idea that if you just work hard, then that's what the problem is. But if something is specifically built so that group A is able to retain power and group B is what's at the expense, right? Like if you ever read the book, The New Jim Crow, or you've watched the documentary 13th, and if you're going to do this kind of work, you should read these books and read these and watch these documentaries. 13th? Yeah. So 13th is a documentary that essentially does a deep dive into the 13th Amendment.
Okay.
Right. And it goes into a lot that analyzes slavery to Jim Crow to mass incarceration. There's a point in the movie where they have a Nixon advisor that is being quoted, who on the record says that they were purposely trying to get mass public opinion to be against anti-war activists and black people.
Yes.
And they said, but we couldn't just forthright say go be against them. So they associated like hippies and anti-war activists with marijuana and black people with crack cocaine. This is how a war on drugs builds itself out. The guy is saying they sat at a table like this and they purposely created a strategy to get people to be against people in this way, you know? And you think, how does government media synergize to create stories?
Yes.
Right? So you have TV shows like Cops that have white men in blue uniforms arresting black people. You have politicians utilizing terms like predator and thug. And then you have this prison industrial complex that disrupts the lives of hundreds of thousands of black people and their families in the immediate. And over time has impacted like millions and millions. The war on terror doesn't build itself out any differently. Politicians utilizing terms like jihadist, fundamentalist, terrorist, Islamist, TV shows like 24 and Homeland. And then you have both domestic and foreign policy that's reflective of these attitudes that are Islamophobic, but it's very purposeful. It takes advantage of the fact that people are separate from each other, that you can get people to be afraid and then render them passive when you are mistreating somebody, yeah. Right? And it gets into your head this idea that this is because I'm not working hard enough. You probably work really hard. I mean, look at what you're doing, right?
Yeah,
we're sitting here on a Wednesday afternoon in the middle of the summer. You could go do whatever you want to, right? But why are you doing this? And you want to be able to think and challenge some of the things that you don't even know that you're thinking about. That you're thinking about, right? Yeah. Do you know? Does that make sense?
Yes, because it's in your head that it could be in your head that, you know, I'm put in this position. I can't do anything about it.
But some people can't do that.
I understand that, but you want to try your best to challenge those ideas.
But the you has to go back to me.
To me, yeah.
Right? Like, I have to see, where do I benefit from these systems that are inequitous? Where is it that I am gaining from them? And how am I willing to let go of what I gain so that nobody is held down?
Yeah.
Do you see?
Yes.
And when people start to do that, that is going to start to make systematic change. But a lot of people benefit from these inequitous systems. So, you know, it's like nobody's going to ever say people should have no food, right? But when you start to ask why do people not have food, that's where people start to get labeled, right? Purposefully,
yeah.
Right? Socialist, communist, like leftist, this and that, whatever. And it's purposeful because you don't want to get to the crux of certain things, right? But when you are a person engaged in faith-based work, the assumption is that you're governed now through a different set of principles and ethics, even if that means that you go against what is normative or no one else is doing it. You're just doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do.
I understand. Moving onwards, this is completely different. But what is your idea of what God looks like?
In Islam, the definition of theology as it pertains to like the divine, to God, is different at like an essential level than other religions, right?
Yes.
Islam is a very purely monotheistic tradition, but not embodying the same essential understandings of God as other religions do. So in Islam, the knowledge of God that we have is a negative knowledge. It's not pessimistically negative, but it's negative in the sense that we know who God is, but
we know who God is. Allah exists, but we have no idea of.
But we know who God is by knowing what He's not, in the sense that there's a verse in the Quran, for example, that says, "Laysa kamithlihi shay." There's not anything that's like a likeness to God.
Right? There's not anything like a likeness to God.
Okay. Right? So it's not even that there's not anything that's like God, but if there was something that was similar to something similar to God, there's not even that. Like more degrees removed, right? If you had a baseline definition, God in Islam is one who is self-sufficient, free of need. And everything in creation is reliant upon God for existence. So the words in Arabic, for example, is the word abd, which quite often gets translated as like a servant, right? Like Abdullah, Abdurrahman, yeah. Right? Kareem Abdul Jabbar, you know? It's that same term that you can say as a servant, but at a base definition, something is abd because it relies on something else to exist, right? Like you and I need oxygen to breathe. You know, we need food to sustain ourselves.
We need water.
We need sleep to be able to rejuvenate and replenish. In an Islamic understanding of theology, there's no anthropomorphizing of God. And God is the one that is like unique in this self-sufficiency, you know? And within that, it's very different from other monotheistic kind of religions and traditions. In Islam too, in the Quran, there's a verse in a chapter called Surah An'am that tells you, like, don't mock people for their beliefs, you know? So there's no reason to kind of look down on somebody because they believe something different. But it's where the theology differs is in this way, that Allah is seen in an essential understanding differently from other monotheistic traditions.
Okay, I understand. And do you believe, is there a heaven and hell? And what do you think they might look like?
Yeah, in Islamic theology, the idea of an afterlife is very definitive. And it's a distinct theological principle from the Meccan society in which Islam is first introduced. The Meccans didn't believe in an afterlife, right? And it rendered no sense of accountability towards them. So why they could bury their daughters alive, they can mistreat people of different races or, you know, lineages of different kinds, etc. It's like this world is the only thing, and that's kind of it. And that's what a modern day, like, secularism also does, right? It's not godless in the sense that no one's talking about God, but it's very purposeful in making you think that this is it, like all that you have is here in this world. So the Quran is something that reiterates again and again and again, pretty much on every page, the mention of an afterlife. And then within that, it gives descriptions of what eternality will look like, both in the standpoint of an ending place that has an heaven and a hell in it, but also intermediary like realms of existence, right? So this world and this worldly existence is just one phase of existence. Prior to this, there's a notion in our theology that every soul was brought into existence as well in an abode of the arwah, the souls. And from there, individual souls, they go into the wombs of like their mother. Some are born into the world, some not. Of those that are born in, they follow this kind of process of aging, you know, you're an infant, a toddler, you know, etc., get to adolescence, teens, you know, adulthood, and then you're elderly. And then death is not seen as an end, but a means to something, where you transition into another phase of existence is called the barzakh, the intermediary realm. It's like the grave. And then from there, there is a day of judgment where everyone is risen from their graves. And each individual is taken into account for their lives in their entirety.
Their actions. And
yeah. And then from there, there's judgment. And then you move into like an eternal phase of existence. in relation to heaven and hell. There's some people who will go right into heaven. There's some people who will spend some time in hell and then be put into heaven. Then there's different opinions on, you know, will there be like people who are in hell forever? Does everybody eventually go to heaven? Right? And God knows best.
God knows best, of course. Yeah. And what prayer have you been praying the longest?
What do you mean?
Meaning, like, the five prayers, daily five prayers, is there one prayer in that that you've never ever missed in your life?
I pray all my five daily prayers. I mean, there's not, so the way that it works.
Has there been one point that you've missed a prayer?
No, I'm pretty consistent in my prayers.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So it's not like a thing that one picks and chooses. There's people who struggle with certain things, right?
I mean, but staying consistent on your five prayers and
yeah.
But ultimately, it's for you. Praying is for you, and it's for God.
Yeah. So, you know, Arabic has like different terms that you can nuance into English translation. So there's like daily ritual prayer, what we call salah.
Yeah.
And your salah is done at five appointed times in a day based off of a cyclical pattern of the sun. You know, the earliest one is when the light from the sun is visible above the horizon until a portion of the sun becomes visible. The second, when the sun begins to descend from its zenith, so not like 12 p.m. noon, but true noon. The third, mid-afternoon. Fourth, sunset. And then fifth is at nighttime.
Yeah.
Right, and so these vary.
There's also the
different times of the year, seasonally.
Yeah. There's also the optional tahajjud.
It's not a mandatory prayer, no. But there's like tons of optional prayers that you could pray in the course of the day. Right, there's one that's immediately after sunrise. There's one right after like the forenoon time. You know, there's prayers that people would pray in the late times of the night, like you're saying. You know, there's
obviously times are subject to change depending on season,
but the five daily ones are things that are required of every Muslim. Imagine. Islam doesn't have like a high bar of entry.
No,
you know, there's very few obligations and few prohibitions, but there are still obligations.
And they're very easy to follow as well. They're not hard to follow.
Yeah. And so it's within that, like that's one form of a word that would be called prayer, your salah. Then the most generic like understanding of worship in Islam is called ibadah, and that's like a category, right? So your fasting, your daily prayers, charity, pilgrimage, you know, these kinds of things. And then what a lot of people say when, you know, I'm praying to God, it's more of like a supplication. In Arabic that would be called dua. And that can be done in any language and any time, pretty much wherever you're sitting.
Understood.
Yeah.
And has there been one dua, like prayer, that you make after your salah and that you've been doing, that you do every time? Is there like a verse in the Quran that's really stuck with you other than the one you mentioned earlier?
I mean, I tend to pray for my parents a lot, for my wife, my kids, my community that I serve. These are like regular, consistent prayers that...
Is there one verse in the Quran that really sticks with you, that you take everywhere and apply the meaning of to your daily life?
I mean, not any one, but all of them, I think, resonate in different ways. I wish I could say, here's one that, like, sticks out, but...
So there's not one notable mention?
I mean, I think there's people who they would say that. I don't have that. Like, that's, you know, okay. There's like a couple of Quranic du'as that I typically make after most prayers. One says, "Rabbirhamhuma kama rabbayani saghira," and that's for like your parents. So, you know, have mercy on them as they did like nurture and care for me when I was younger. There's one in reference to like your spouses and children that says, "Rabbana hablana min azwajina wa dhurriyyatina qurrata ayun." وَجَعَلْنَا لِلْمُتَّقِينَ إِمَامًا. And it's, you know, give to me from my spouse and my children a coolness of the eyes, and make us for the people of consciousness, taqwa, leaders. But, you know, Arabic is really beautiful. So, like in that prayer, it says hablana, which means to give.
Yep.
But in Arabic, like the word hibba is a gift. right? So it's different from when you say like Ata or like Rabbana Atina or something like this, right? So you're saying like, gift me with this. In a coolness of the eyes, this isn't like an English like construct, you know, but you know, you'd want to think in a desert like type setting where people have all kinds of things blowing in their face. Or like my son and I, we were playing basketball at the park the other day, and he's like a little kid, 7 years old, and he got an eyelash in his eye, and it just totally threw off his day. And all of a sudden he's like trying to put water on it, rubbing his eye, and he was having so much fun before. And then after like 10-15 minutes, he tried and he was like, let's just go home. He was very dejected, and he said, let me just try one more time. And he did, and the eyelash came out, and he was super elated, you know, like really excited.
Yeah, really excited.
You know,
so you can get back to play.
But the relief that he felt getting this thing out of his eye, that's like what the coolness of the eye is, right? Like when I come home and I just look at my wife, I look at my kids, it instantaneously brings like solace to me, right? That's what the prayer is asking
for. Yeah,
that's
nice. Yeah. And why do you think that some prayers might go unanswered?
I mean, in our religious understanding in Islam, you know, one, the idea is that God hears every prayer.
Yeah.
And so the response to the prayer is either you're given what you're asking for, or you're given something better. It's kept from you, you know, to give you something better, or that you will get it like eternally.
Yeah.
Right. But the notion is that, you know, like God is not like a birthday cake, right? You're not making wishes in that way, nor is Islam a religion where God is subservient to you. You're subservient to God. Yeah. And so what might seem like it's something unanswered is really just about
answered, yeah.
like thinking, you know, in a frame of reliance on the divine.
Yeah.
And in Islam, like, you know, of the things that we are taught of God, he is Al-Alim. He's the one that knows everything. He's Al-Hakim. He's the most wise. So it's in his wisdom that he answers prayers.
So either either Allah will give you what you're asking for immediately, or he has something in better for you in store, that may be given not in one's lifetime, and in one's lifetime, but a prolonged period later. Yeah, it's really interesting, and it's a very reassuring piece of knowledge. Like, it's a very reassuring idea that Allah has listened to your prayers. He will give it to you. We don't know when. Could be now. Could be later. Could be when we pass, or he could give you something better. It's very reassuring. So that when you
meet the fundamentally, what it comes down to is, who is God to you, right? Like, Islam is not
how close are you. How
religion.
Close are you to God?
Well, you'd have to know. Like, you could believe God created you. It doesn't mean that you believe that he's merciful, right? Or like think in that way. Like, there's a prophetic tradition that says, "Ana inda dhani abdi bi," I am as my servant thinks I am.
Okay.
Right? So the God you believe God to be is the God that you're going to worship. And for many people, there's a paradox to decision making. You know, when you don't make a choice, you've still essentially chosen. So they have a very unconsciously formulated understanding of who God is.
Yes.
You know, and our tradition teaches us about a God that's not just watching us, but watching over us. You know, a God that loves us more than a mother loves his child. But for many people, they conceptualize God to be like an angry old man in the sky looking for a reason to punish them. And you're making dua, like you're praying to God, you know?
Yeah.
And so within that, you can like pray how somebody else prays or dresses how somebody else dresses. You can't believe something just because somebody else believes it, beliefs in your heart. So you'd want to pause and try to think, well, who is God to me in the first place, right? Who is it that I'm asking of these things? And then where do I draw a sense of like trust in that God, right?
Yeah.
Do I believe in a God that believes in me more than I believe in myself? Or do I believe in a God that's looking to push me down? And then the solace that comes from prayer is going to be hard to find if, you know, your conceptualization of God makes you walk around on eggshells. Do you know?
Yes.
And so being Muslim is not a sociological identity variable. Like, you're not Muslim in the sense that it's an inherited religion, but the theology is a discursive theology. You have to be able to explain, like, why do you believe in the Quran? You know,
why do you believe in the stuff you believe in? You should have a good understanding of your explanation. It's not just like,
because my dad told me to, my mom, my grandma told me to, you know? So it comes from also reflection, contemplation.
Yeah. And being a well-known religious leader, what's the best part of being one? And how do you help the NYU community and the greater New York community with your knowledge and understandings?
We have a great community here, alhamdulillah. There's about 4,000 Muslim students in NYU. A lot of people who live and work in the area come to our center. So we estimate it's about 10,000-12,000 people that consider this their community.
So it's pretty very significant.
Diverse. That's large. And with that, I get to meet just really amazing people every day. I have the blessing of being part of a community that's very kind and caring. I know a lot of people who serve religious communities, whether they're Muslim or otherwise, where
places that are not.
People are just treat them really poorly. And over here, people are really
encouraging, really nice, supportive,
helpful. Yeah, and so it makes a big difference. And then for me, you know, I don't think I was given a platform to be self-serving. So I'm just trying to build as much as I can.
That's
so outside
always
of
important,
our center
yeah.
here, we've opened a domestic violence shelter, you know, Sunday school, some charitable organizations.
Where's the Sunday school? Sorry.
There's one in Midtown Manhattan.
Yeah, because I remember I did a Sunday school for the longest time in for the financial district.
Okay.
I'm not sure who it was run by, but
I'm not sure,
But it was.
But so the idea for us is we're gonna build out clinics and pantries.
Yeah,
and,
you opened up a domestic abuse.
We have
center.
An organization called Pillars of Peace.
Yes.
It's a
yes.
domestic violence agency.
Yeah.
And that was one that we opened pre-COVID.
Okay.
And then COVID
it's relatively
came in.
New then.
Yeah, and so COVID kind of derailed some of our plan, and we pivoted. We raised about $10 million.
Oh wow.
To assist people with micro cash grants. You know, New York was mm-hmm. a big mess for a while. So food insecurity, survivors of abuse stuck at home now with their abusers,
yeah.
funeral assistance, like all kinds
of things.
And they're
all given a safe place to stay.
Yeah, things like that. So now we're trying to get back to where we were before and think out in the next 10 years, what
trying
are
we trying to get back on track.
Yeah, let's build the medical clinics and wellness centers and, you know, food pantries, et cetera,
yeah.
things like that.
And what do you, and in your idea, what are healthy ways, in your opinion, to deal with stress and pressure?
It's going to vary from person to person. Self-care, I think, is a really important thing that many people don't have for themselves or regular
yeah.
outlets. The two questions that I ask people the most that I get the answer of I don't know to is when they're very honest and vulnerable. I'll say, what are your values? Like, what's important to you? And most just really don't know, right? Not ones that they just claim or kind of regurgitate, but based off of their decisions, how they spend their time, like what would really demonstrate to them what's important to them. And they say, I don't know. And then the second I say, how do you take care of your heart? Like, what are your outlets? And they say, I don't know. And you go through most people's routines.
And it's missing.
You know, if you don't design your life, someone else is going to design it for you.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people that end up chasing after things that they think is going to be good for
it's
them.
It's not beneficial.
In my work, you know, I'll quite often sit with people who are at the end of life, and nobody's ever sat with me when they know they're about to die, like in the next couple of days or weeks or months, and say, I wish I had more time to go to an office or like fight with people or post on social media.
Yeah.
But they're saying, I wish I had more time to spend with my loved ones. I wish I like... told
so
somebody
like experience, you know, life. I wish I had more time to,
yeah, or like I told someone I love them, or that I apologize for the wrong I did to them, you know. And so that regret is rooted in certain things, and I think self-care is important. You have a physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual sphere to yourself, and a lot of people just run on empty, like they're super exhausted. You know, I am a professor here at NYU,
yeah,
I'm the university's chaplain, I'm the
especially in
director
high school,
of the Islamic Center, you know, and all these things. I have two kids, my parents are sick. Community is large, businesses.
You have
non-profits.
A lot to manage, basically.
I still wake up and go to the gym every day.
That's good.
I have personal things that I do. I see my friends. Like, I'm able to make time for these things. Saying yes to something means you're going to inevitably say no. But I think quite often people don't realize just how much time they do have. And when they're saying, I don't have time for something, they're really saying it's not important to me. And how would your routine tell you that you are important to you?
Yeah, your routine plays a big role in how you might deal with stress. And I think...
And you're saying high school kids are really stressed. It's crazy. I see college kids who come straight out of high school and they sit with me and they kill themselves because they feel bad about resting. And I was just like, you need to rest.
You need to rest,
like,
to recover.
You have these arbitrary metrics of success that are coming at the expense of your overall wellness. It makes no sense.
I mean, the way I would deal with stress is, first, I would, like, evaluate the situation. Like, is it really as stressful as I'm telling people for it to be? Like, and what can I do to improve it? And then I would turn towards God and my soul. I would ask him to ease the stress and help me get through the pressure. And so I think evaluating your stress levels and what the deadline actually is, what do you have to do, is a lot more important, because then it could help break down your time into chunks and help you organize.
How do you sleep? How do you eat? You know, what is, like, your mental wellness routine, emotional? Even things that are good for you can be exhausting. And when people are running on empty, it's not that they're weak, but they need when you expend strength, it doesn't make you weak. It just... You know, if you don't have an outlet to replenish, then you're just going to be tired. And most people just get really debilitated at the end of the day, right? And it's a challenge.
Yeah. And
I'm going to have to stop in a little bit. I'm so sorry, man. There's a class that I teach.
Can you do one more question?
Sure.
So how can Muslims and other believers and non-believers get along more and get along better?
People need to spend more time with each other, I think. In meaningful, substantive ways. I think also being able to recognize that there's some people who fundamentally, they just don't want to get along with other people. And you'd have to be smart about being able to say, like, what is this relationship really bringing? And is this something that's just kind of patronizing and tokenizing? Versus, like, this is somebody who genuinely wants
to know more.
Yeah, and be with somebody else, do you know?
Yes.
So that you're able to connect at a level of interdependence that sees us all kind of in a sphere of kind of existence together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's it for now. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, man.
Pleasure to have you.
I hope it went okay.
It went incredible.
Yeah, let me know when you put it up.
I'll try for sure. Thank you so much. Bye.
So is there someone picking you up from here? All right, did you?